help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is going to be a recap on some of the most important patching things that you need to be aware of. So this includes not only your residential users, but also the IT managers out there. And then we're going to get on to part two of the first half of the year ransomware report analysis, which I promised you I'd do part two of that. Okay, so let's get started. First, some big things that I've seen lately is some folks that have Exchange and SQL servers not realizing that these things are not going to patch themselves automatically. And I hope you can understand the reason why you don't see the patches for SQL and Exchange typically through Windows Update. Typically, you're not going to find them in Windows Software Update services. You might find them in a third-party patch application like Kaseya. However, that all being said, you really need to be manually patching SQL servers and Exchange servers because of the sensitivity of doing those patches. And I've recently run into some individuals who just literally had not patched their SQL and Exchange servers in 3 years because they thought that the Windows Software Update server was doing it for them. And as a result, those servers are in extremely poor condition at this point. It took like an act of God in order to even get the patch to install at this point. When you let a server go for so long, you can anticipate that not only are you going to have problems, but on top of that, your attempt to then later actually install that patch just becomes insanely more difficult. Especially if you're using an old version of Exchange or an old version of SQL that are not quite as robust as the latest versions. Speaking of that, this is another prime example as to why you have to stay up to date with your applications. So I think a lot of IT managers look at it and say, well, you know, I don't want to go from, you know, Exchange 2010 to Exchange 2013 because, boy, that's a lot of money. And you're right. You're probably going to pay $16,000 to $20,000 in terms of licensing. Now, I would argue maybe it's time for you to go to Office 365. However, the reality is if you're using an application that's effectively 7 years old, how reliable do you expect that thing to be? The other thing is, you're probably real close to end of life on that product anyways. So in my 22 years of experience of working on servers and networks and endpoints in general, your most reliable server and business application environment comes from one where you are actively looking for patches and upgrades 4 times a year. I know that sounds a lot, but if you've got a SQL-based app, your SQL-based app is the application vendor is going to provide you, it says, well, we support this version of SQL, and here's the latest patch for our application, and we support this version of the operating system, and that. Keep your finger on the pulse of what that is that's going on, and then get a game plan together to stay on top of those patches. If you don't, I guarantee you it will blow up in your face at some point in time later. And the expense that your organization will go through in order to just get that issue resolved is going to be significantly more than what the cost would have been to just stay up to date the entire time. I see so many people trying to avoid expenses by not updating their software. And then they end up spending thousands of dollars on consulting labor. And you know, the reality is all you ever had to do was just stay updated. So please, please just stay updated. It avoids business outages and it avoids spending tons of money on labor that really you should have been spending on making things better rather than just fixing broken stuff. So, all right, so keep up to date on the patches. Now, along the line of this whole patching thing, Microsoft has, as of October 2016, so this month, they have completely changed how patches are going to be deployed for Windows 7, Windows 8.1, Server 2008 R2, Server 2012, Server 2012 R2. Now, of course, I would hope you all realize that Server 2016 and Windows 10 already have a very, very, very different patching model anyways. Well, now the old methodology of being able to screw up your environment by not patching in the right order or leaving something patched for a very long period of time and just, you know, having a variety of configurations that are just going to blow up in your face, Microsoft is saying, you know, look, this is just ridiculous. We can't test the ubiquitous number of potential configurations out there. And ultimately, customers want more reliable experience. So the only way to get there is to force you to install the patches, right? You need to be installing the patches anyways, so why aren't you? Is always a head-scratcher for me. Why aren't you installing the patches? Well, there's a lot of organizations that just goof around. You know, they just goof off, and they get behind, and they don't pay attention to the regular maintenance on their systems. Well, right now, as it is, if you've got a Windows 10 or a Server 2016 device, you will not be able to delay more than 3 updates. That's it. And if you delay those, you're not getting any more updates. Now you've just got a Wild West system on your hands, because not only does it not have the security patches, but it doesn't have the reliability patches either. Just catastrophically bad idea. So please... take a look at the two articles. These are TechNet blog posts that I will post, and this explains it in great deal. And effectively, this means that you're going to be getting cumulative updates, and it just is what it is. Now, there's another really significant thing to understand with all of this. So Microsoft does this extensive, and I do mean extensive, testing with OEM equipment. So we're talking Dell, HP. Yes, there's some other brands, but we're primarily talking about Dell and HP. Okay. Microsoft does extensive OEM testing on hardware driver, hardware configurations, driver configurations, and then their operating systems. So if your goal is to have reliable infrastructure for your organization, or just to have a reliable workstation or laptop for you to work from, then you need to either be using a Microsoft Surface Pro, or you need to be utilizing a Dell business class system or an HP business class system. I'm not even going to say Lenovo, because Lenovo is made in China and I don't trust it, not for any business here in the United States. And IBM server hardware is nowhere near as good as Dell or HP server hardware. So if you decide you're going to go to a place like Supermicro, as an example, and you're just going to think you're saving yourself money by putting together parts and pieces and saying, you know, I'm just going to take all these like disparate parts and pieces and build my own server. Well, what you now have on your hands is a piece of equipment that it's likely you're the only human being on the planet that actually has that particular configuration of hardware. Microsoft certainly doesn't have that piece of equipment in their data centers that they're doing compatibility testing with Microsoft updates on. So you've now just introduced the potential that an update is going to do something really naughty to your system, because you're not using an OEM box. Now, there's other things like, who do you even go to for warranty support on that thing? Do you even have any ability to do a comprehensive one-place diagnostics? So, I mean, I just, even for a workstation, I don't have any desire to build these things individually, because if you are looking to have reliable systems in production, whether it's a workstation, a laptop, or a server, just buy OEM equipment that comes with the diagnostics capabilities, that comes with the ability for you to call a single vendor, get assistance with that thing, and for you to be able to have a single vendor to call for warranty issues and anything like that. And then, of course, the compatibility testing with Microsoft updates that other people are doing that you then benefit from. So really, under all circumstances that I can come up with, no value. You're really not saving any money by buying something from like Supermicro or Tiger Direct or whatever. If you're some sort of an IT geek and you want to do some stuff at home, yeah, still, frankly, I wouldn't do it. But, if you just really want to do that, I'm not going to stop you. But if you're trying to run a business on that, I mean, do not expect that you're going to have something that's really reliable. I mean, I'm looking for equipment that I'm going to be able to make a phone call and I've got somebody who's showing up at the facility within 4 hours with the part that is required in order to correct the problem. All right. Or next business day, whatever is appropriate for your organization. All right, so let's get on to part two of the first half of 2016 ransomware and malware analysis. So we're talking about global trends here. So the breakdown of known infection vectors used to distribute ransomware was 71% spam. Yeah. Very, very interesting. 71% of ransomware is being distributed through spam. 18% is coming through exploit kits, 3% coming through the app stores. All right, so we're talking about either the Google Play Store or we're talking about the Apple Store. Okay. 5% are coming through just straight out exploits against the operating system. Now, that's in addition to an exploit kit, which is at the 18%. But the real big piece here is 71% through spam. So I've talked for quite a while in the past about why you need to be stopping the bad doo-doo before it ever gets to your endpoint. You got to stop the bad doo-doo before it ever gets to your workstations. So people are utilizing email systems where there's a server-side component to that. You need to be utilizing an email system that you're also providing an advanced persistent threat scanning. So your typical malware, virus, anti-spam, whatever, I mean, this analysis is all still fine and good. You need those factors. But unless you're using something like Trend Micro's Cloud App Security product plugged into your Office 365 tenant, or unless you've subscribed to WatchGuard's Advanced Persistent Threat Blocker module, and then you've got an on-premise Exchange server, and you've got APT scanning turned on in the SMTP proxy, then in that case, if you don't have like one of those two scenarios going on, you do not have APT blocking for ransomware. And I can tell you that this stuff is absolutely necessary and it's absolutely effective. I can't tell you how many times I've actually been attacked by various whoever bad guys are out there trying to get to me through the email system, and my layers of protection block that stuff. That's why I actually use multiple layers of protection. So you have to utilize something that has APT blocking and scanning, and this is, the whole sandboxing. So it's this matter of having the defense that does reputation-based analysis. It blocks, and it blocks based upon reputation, script emulation, zero-day exploit detection, the whole sandboxing component. Behavioral monitoring, and all of these things kind of come under the guise of APT, okay, Advanced Persistent Threat Scanning and Blocking, right? So the solutions are out there. Now, as part of that, this whole statistic of 71% of this ransomware is getting delivered via spam. So clearly, if you have a more advanced spam blocker, all right, just that alone is going to help. But then, even if something's a very finely crafted message to where it passes spam scanners, which, oh, I do see them. I do see them. But then you need to have another layer, as I said, that APT scanning that's going to look at all of the contents and literally detonate that email in a sandbox before it ever gets delivered to you. So there's this whole category called BEC, Business Email Compromise Schemes. Now, these are scam tactics that are intended to compromise business accounts so that an unauthorized fund transfer can happen. So this is part of banking fraud. Now, So business email compromise is very much so in that category of spear phishing and targeted attacks against like the assistance of an executive, these sorts of things. We have brute force attacking to get this type of stuff done, social engineering issues to get business email compromise schemes to work. And of course, part of that is also getting malware on the endpoint. So, you know, the effectiveness of these BEC scams lies in the techniques that are employed against the preferred targets that are, you know, that are being spear phished effectively. So the attackers are typically deceiving victims by combining their knowledge of the social engineering techniques as well as very, very, very well-researched information about the target. So as I said, in many cases, it is the assistant of the CFO or the CEO or a controller that is being targeted, and then the bad guy pretends as if they are the CEO, the CFO, or the controller, and then telling the assistant to make that funds transfer. So clearly, if you're in any of those scenarios, you need to have a protocol in place where all the staff know that funds transfers will never be authorized except through an absolute verbal confirmation system. Because I think you could agree that you know, we are pretty good at detecting who it is who's talking to us on the phone. Now, granted, I'll give you that, you know, the NSA and nation state actors certainly have voice print alteration software systems to make it sound like they are somebody else, right? But your typical attacker is not going to necessarily have access to that. And so if you had a system in place where the assistant to the CFO knew that no transfer could actually be authorized unless that assistant was able to get verbal, like voice print verbal authorization from the CFO, then that would be a pretty good protocol. So in a lot of these cases, these attacks are being successful simply because that sort of a protocol is not in place. And, you know, when you're looking at something like that, clearly having that sort of protocol in place does not cost you anything. It's just a policy. It's just a simple practice and procedure you put in place. Something else that I thought was really interesting in this is the component of getting malware on the endpoints and utilizing keystroke loggers in these business email compromise campaigns to steal those credentials for the banking transactions. And so that's, you know, totally in use. And one of the ways that you can combat that is multi-factor authentication for your banking application. And I'm not talking about the thing where it shows you the little, this is our security image, and put in your second phrase. No, I'm literally talking about like a disconnected fob, you know, some sort of like a YubiKey or an RSA token or an authenticator app or text messaging. Even State of Wisconsin, kudos to State of Wisconsin for enabling multi-factor authentication on all of the tax accounts. So if you submit personal State of Wisconsin tax, or if you submit business State of Wisconsin tax, your State of Wisconsin online tax account now is protected and mandated to use multi-factor authentication. So kudos to State of Wisconsin for doing that. And the way that they did it was with a disconnected device. So you can do text messaging. There is also the component of email verification. So you have to be a little careful of the email verification method, that if your email is also compromised and somebody's put a keystroke logger on your machine, well, yeah, now they can actually get into your account. So I really think that all multi-factor authentication systems are better than not having multi-factor authentication, but the best systems are those that utilize a completely disconnected device, and it's actually much more difficult to compromise a phone than it is you know, to get a keystroke logger on somebody's device. But at the same time, SMS is nowhere as near as, SMS meaning text messaging, is nowhere as near as secure as an HTTPS encrypted authenticator app. All right. So, if your bank does not yet support multi-factor authentication, please call them up and say, "Hey, you really need to get this." All right. So let's talk about some of the other ways that these endpoints are getting compromised. We talked, I think, in part one a little bit about, at a very high level, that Flash Player vulnerabilities tended to be an extremely high percentage attack vector in the first half of this year. And that is because people are not patching Flash. Now, if you're using Chrome, you can use ScriptSafe. If you have Windows 8 and or Windows 10, then the Internet Explorer and Edge browser component of Flash is automatically being patched through Microsoft Update, which is that's really cool. Chrome does not use Flash at all, but so the thing you have to be worried about is the Flash component inside of Firefox. So number one, if you have an older operating system than Windows 8, you need to be concerned. And then also, if you're using Firefox, you'd better make darn sure that your Flash inside of Firefox is patched. Now, when we look at what are these Flash Player exploits really, where are they originating from? Well, they're basically almost all malvertisements, and then the other component of it is zero-day vulnerabilities in things that are considered, Internet of Things. So it's the old code that isn't getting patched inside of a web UI for a webcam, or these sorts of varieties of things. So the Internet of Things appliances that are out there that are not really made by manufacturers who are really interested in security. So you need to be blocking malvertisements. And my personal opinion is that you should just block advertisements straight across the board because you really don't have any idea which ones are legit advertisements and which ones are malvertisements. And when we look at the statistical percentage, we can see that it's in excess of 70% of all advertisements are actually hosting malware. And I mean, it's so bad that I can go to certain IT security websites, and I am not kidding you. We're talking about IT security websites. You'd think that whoever is managing these websites would really have their finger on the pulse of securing these websites, right? Well, that's not always the case, because I can tell you about months and months and months of time where you go to an IT security website. And what you end up with is your security system alerts you to tell you that there is a ransomware attack vector attempting to be getting delivered to your machine through a Flash exploit. Yeah. Now, you would only ever know about that if you actually had a properly configured, multi-layered defense in depth security strategy in place that provided you that level of alerting. Now, in general, when I configure these things for client sites, I don't send the alerts to the general users of the computer, obviously, but those alerts most definitely should be going to the IT manager. And it's really handy if you are the IT manager and you are browsing some websites, and then right in concert with you browsing websites, you get these notifications that tell you about, oh, this problem happened. Then what you can do is correlate and say, clearly that website is hacked. So, as an example, every time I've gone to a website called Dark Reading for though many months now, it's hacked. There is something that is on that website that is trying to deliver ransomware through Flash. So here's darkreading.com, which is an IT security website, and it's hacked. So the fact is, you have no idea what websites are hacked, what websites are not hacked. You have to have this multi-layered defense in depth strategy going on to protect you. All right, so let's talk about data breaches in general. We found in the first half of 2016, data breaches were really, really, really problematic. Lots of PII and PHI, login credentials, payment card data, all kinds of stuff used to conduct financial fraud, identity theft, blackmail, espionage, and extortion. All of this stuff has just been rampant in the first half of 2016. So, looking at where these data breaches are coming from, interestingly enough, 41% of all data breaches are coming from physical device loss incidents. So, a phone that's lost, a laptop that's lost, a workstation that's stolen. So the rules that I put in place are that unless that device is physically inside a hardened physical location, then it should, number one, it should be fully shut down, not just in sleep mode, but fully shut down when the user is not actively utilizing that, with the exception of a patch window or something like that. Then it needs to be encrypted. So we're talking your phones need to be encrypted. And if your phone is not physically with you, shut it down. If your laptop is not physically with you, shut it down. And it better have encryption on it. Why do we need to shut it down? Well, because somebody could actually, with physical access, walk up to your computer, plug in a special USB hack tool, get your Windows credentials, log into your existing session, and whammo, they've got everything. Okay, but if you actually shut that computer down and you have encryption in place, now they actually cannot boot up that computer without the decryption password. And I've talked before about the fact that you must use at least a 10-digit decryption password, if not 12. There is a limit. I don't think you can exceed 16, depending upon what the encryption system is that you're using, but that's generally what the range is 10 to 16 characters, okay? So, device loss. And the thing is, this is so simple to mitigate. Just shut down the devices when you're not using them and then encrypt them all. Now, the second component of device, right next to device loss, when we're talking about popular breach methods here, is the brute force attack and social engineering. So, we've previously already talked about the social engineering component where a target will be selected, a bunch of research will be done on that target, maybe it's the CFO, and then the bad guys will find out who's the assistant to the CFO, and then they'll start formulating really finely crafted attack vectors, typically being delivered through email, that are going to attempt to install some malware that'll install a keystroke logger, any variety of things like that that's going to compromise that endpoint to steal credentials. Or in some cases, just outright trick that person to m into making a an e you know an e EFT or an ACH funds transfer, one of the others, so some sort of a banking funds transfer that really was not intended to be done. So the brute force attacking, something that you should really be aware of is, I would say that virtually all of the internet-facing email systems that are out there that are detached from an on-premise Active Directory environment. So we're going to talk about hosted Exchange, Gmail potentially. We're going to talk about any sort of hosted Exchange, Office 365, and so forth. So these systems, unless you're using something like ADFS and multi-factor authentication, then they are vulnerable to just brute force attack. So if you're using Office 365 or hosted Exchange through Intermedia, or you're using Gmail, anything like that, you really need to be using multi-factor authentication because otherwise your account can be brute force attacked. All right, well, that's it for today's show. Do look at the website for all the links associated with the articles I talked about.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD.